Now, you may remember if you were here back in October last year when I last spoke, and if you weren't here, then what I did speak about was, it was the first words of Jesus' public ministry. And at that time, Jesus asked a question, what do you want? Well, the boot's on the other foot today, because we're going to look at something else that Jesus said, but this time, rather than Jesus asking a question is asked to Jesus. You'll notice in verse 35 that the question was asked as a test. That differentiates it from the question that Jesus asked, because Jesus' question was an invitation. When Jesus was speaking to mankind for the first time, he gave an invitation. When mankind speaks to God, they test him. I have some empathy with Jesus when he was asked that question, because shortly after the last time I spoke, Pat was doing the Sunday school, and when it all finished, I went down into the Sunday school to tell her that the service had ended and she could come out. And when I got down to the Sunday school, there was Pat there and there was Jennifer there. Yeah, Jennifer's in Sunday school again, isn't she, today? Pat's there and Jennifer's there. And the children were just finishing the prayers at the end of their Sunday school. So I sat down at the table. And when the prayers ended, Pat says to the children, do you want to ask David a question? And I wasn't ready for that. And one of the children, one of the girls, and I'm sorry, I don't know their names because, people have come since COVID, but I can tell you it's one of the girls that sits on the front here. I don't know if it's Alice, Michael, Justin, Rachel, Rebecca. Yeah. I don't know whose it was, but one of the girls asked me this question. She said, tell me the Ten Commandments. And it was like her eyes were piercing. What are the Ten Commandments? And I sort of started stumbling my way through, and she's waiting for me to go wrong. And I got part way through them, and then she said, don't steal. And I thought, I got to that. Give me a chance. So I have some empathy about people who are tested, and particularly about the commandments. Let's just look at verse 34, because I think we need to look at who actually asked this question. And we see in verse 34, it was the Pharisees. I'm reading from a slightly different version, so sorry if I don't read the same as on there. But in my version it says, but when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. When I looked at this, I thought, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, who were the Pharisees? Because we don't hear about them in the Old Testament, and we don't hear about them today. So who actually were they? Well, there were one of the groups that existed within Judaism at that time. There are a number of groups. The largest ones were, first of all, the Essenes. They're the people who we think lived in the Dead Sea area and were responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls. We know more about them since the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947. Although there is some debate now as to whether the Dead Sea Scrolls were Essenic in origin. What distinguished the Essenes were they lived a separate existence. They came out of the world and lived as a separate community. In a way, they're a bit like the monasteries were prior to the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. Me and Pat have just been on holiday, and we visited one of the ruins, Brevo Abbey, well worth a visit to see the ruins, but very costly, but worth a visit. But what's interesting is that I always thought that monks don't exist anymore, but they do. In fact, when I was at university, I did one of, I won't say he was a friend, but somebody I knew fairly well. He was an ex-monk. And whilst we were at Rivo Abbey, we visited Ampleforth Abbey, which still has monks. And he'd come from Ampleforth Abbey. Went to Ampleforth Abbey, and we heard these monks singing Gregorian chant. And it was really wonderful and moving. We're sort of just outside the main church hall at the monastery, and it was wonderful. And you can understand why people are uplifted by that time of religious worship. But unfortunately, they miss the point. We're not called to come out of the world. We're called to be in the world, but not of the world. Well, they were the Essenes. The other grouping we've already heard of in this passage, because Jesus had spoken to them very soon before this incident. And that group was the Sadducees. The Sadducees were drawn from they were the rulers of Israel at that time. And they had authority in the temple, and they were all to do with temple worship. They drew their ancestry from Zadok the priest, and they believed that purity came through going to the temple and offering the temple sacrifices. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were the largest group in Judaism, and they were the group of the common people. They believed that purity should be found in the whole aspect of every part of your life, not just by way of temple worship, but within life itself. Now, unlike the Sadducees, who believed the law of Moses as set out in what is now our Bible, the Pharisees also believed in the oral tradition that had arisen as part and together with the law. So they believed that when Moses was given the law, he was also given the gift of interpretation of the law. And traditions had evolved around that oral interpretation of it. And the Pharisees believed in not just the written law, but that oral law as well. The oral law eventually was set down in what's called the Mishnah. And it actually forms the basis of Judaism today, of rabbinic Judaism. So Pharisees actually, in a sense, still exist because their teachings became the fundamentals of what is now Judaism. The Sadducees died out in AD 70 when the temple was destroyed by the Romans, because with no temple, there's no need for temple sacrifices. The Pharisees are the group, in a sense, that survived because they became the foundation of Judaism. And their belief in purity in life, and not just at the temple, gave rise to the synagogue system. They've had a very bad press, haven't they? If you carry on reading into chapter 23, that's when Jesus really has a go at the Pharisees, because whilst they sought purity in life by obeying the law, they can be accused of being hypocrites. The law becomes mellowed because of their teachings. They had 39 practices that weren't allowed on the Sabbath day. And they interpreted that in different ways. For example, you could only sew two threads on the Sabbath day. If you sewed a third thread, then you committed a sin. You could only write two letters, and I don't mean writing letters that you would send to somebody, but two letters. So if you're writing my name, you can write D-A on the Sabbath day, but if you wrote V-I-D to finish it off, then that would be a sin. Now, I've been looking at the Babylonian Talmud, The Talmud was, well, the Talmud is, the Jewish law. It's the Torah, which we have as the first five books of the Bible, plus this oral tradition, which is the Mishnah. And then, as the Mishnah interprets the Torah, the Mishnah itself is interpreted in the Gemara. And the Mishnah and Gemara together, with the Talmud, I've been looking at the Babylonian Talmud, and for the Sabbath day, there are 24 chapters of rules about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath day. And that's how much they tried to change the fundamental laws of God. So when Jesus called them hypocrites, it's understandable because they were very orientated to obeying the letter of the law with its weakened interpretation rather than the spirit of the law. So that's the Pharisees. In verse 36, then, we start to look at the question. The question is, which is, in my translation, it says, which is the great commandment in the law, or the greatest commandment in the law? There's a passage that mirrors this in Mark chapter 12 at verse 28. And in that passage, the question that's asked is, what's the most important commandment? So that's the sense of the question that's asked. What's the most important? What's the greatest commandment? You can see that would put Jesus into something of a dilemma. Does he choose one above the other? Or does this, when he could be criticised and say, well, surely that's no more important than this one? Or does he, in a sense, cop out and say, well, none of them's the greatest? Well, then you'd get them asking further questions like, well, you know, in situations where the laws might conflict with one another. You know, if you take do not commit adultery, the sentence was death by stoning. So are you allowed to kill if someone commits adultery? You can see the dilemma it would have. And he gives this great answer. And the answer is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That's a great answer. It's not actually original, because Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament. He's quoting from what's known in Judaism as the Shema. And that's contained in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. It starts off with the words, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." The Shema, is something that has been prayed by Jews for thousands of years in the morning and in the evening. The beginning of the Shema isn't mentioned here, but again, if you look at the parallel passage in Mark 12:28, you'll see that it's the whole Shema that's mentioned, including, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." Looking at the individual parts of the Shema, first of all, we're called upon to love the Lord your God. Now, love in English, I think, is a very misused word. We use it for lots of things that are not true love. You might say, "I love chocolate," or "I love Blackburn Rovers." I'm looking at Helen here. I might love Liverpool or love Manchester United. Well, do you? Do you send Cadbury's flowers? Do you send Blackburn Rovers flowers or Liverpool flowers? Do you really love them? And if you do, does your husband or wife, do they know you love somebody else? It's a very misused word. we just say it glibly in some ways. Well, in Greek, there were 8 words for love. And in Koine Greek, which is the Greek of the New Testament, there were 4 words for love. The first one of those is eros. That signifies romantic or sexual love. The second word was philia, and that signifies a deep friendship. Now, before I go on, it's worth, if you want to read the Bible for all it's worth, then it's worth, when you come to a passage and you find the word love used, it's worth finding out which word translated love we're actually talking about. It always amuses me that in 1 Corinthians 13, we have that great passage of love. And people use it for their wedding service, particularly those non-Christians that might be having a church service. I think the vicar or priest will push them into having 1 Corinthians 13. Well, in 1 Corinthians 13, the word is not philia or eros. It's the word agape, which I'll come to in a minute. But the point is that what you're talking about there is not romantic love, because that would be eros. It's purely platonic love. And therefore it seems totally inappropriate to use it in a wedding service, quite apart from 1 Corinthians 13 being to do with the gifts of the Spirit, or in a passage in relation to gifts of the Spirit. It seems totally inappropriate. I have a friend who's getting married in May of this year, and she's getting married in church, and I asked her which Bible passage she was using for a wedding service, and she hadn't decided at that time. So, well, don't use 1 Corinthians 13. And I explained why. And then I thought, I've put my foot in it. Because she said to me, well, what passage shall I use? And I thought, what do I say? Well, I quite like that passage in Philippians chapter 2 where it talks about you being stars in a wicked and corrupt generation. And I thought, these stars shining, that could be the bride and the groom. That'd be good. But I'm not sure how well the congregation would go down with being called a wicked and corrupt generation. So I thought, no, not that one. I've not yet thought of one. This is a few weeks ago, so if anybody has got any good ideas, then please let me know, because I have really put my foot in it. Anyway, philia, unlike eros, which is, as I say, romantic and sexual in nature, philia, the next word for love used, is one that signifies a deep friendship, a friendship that you could have between two males, for example. A third word that the Koine Greek uses, and ancient Greek uses, is storge, and that signifies a love that gives pride in your country. I just heard about President Zelensky in the Ukraine. He's proud of his country. That's the love he has for his country, storge love. And it also applies to love that you would have for your children, the pride that you would have in your own children. And the fourth word for love is one I've already referred to. It's the highest form of love, and that is agape. And that signifies brotherly love. It's purely platonic in nature. There's no sexual connotations within it. And it's a word that you would love, a word that you would use in respect of your siblings, for example. But it's also the word that is used in the New Testament to describe the love of God. But what is the love of God? what is agape in that sense. And I'm drawn in explaining that to John 3:16, the classic John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but shall have everlasting life. That's God's love. Now, the one thing that I think about that verse, God so loved the world. God loved the world tremendously, so much. He loved the world so much that he sent his one and only Son. But you know, that misses something. Yes, he does love the world so much. But in a way, it gives the impression that it's something that we did. And that's why he loves the world so much, because of something the world did. He loved the world so much because of something we did. That could be the impression. When you look at the ancient Greek for that word so in John 3:16, what I think of is Blue Peter. Now, the Americans won't know what Blue Peter is. But if you're my age and you come from this country, or younger or slightly older, you know what Blue Peter is. I think they still have it, but it's not like it was in the 70s and 80s. Do you remember when Blue Peter made models and they showed you how to make them? I was always terrible, I couldn't do it anyway. But they'd tell you how to make a model, and they'd do something, and they'd say, you do it so, you do it like this. This is how you do it. Well, in the ancient Greek, in the Koine Greek, that word so can mean in this way. So you can translate John 3:16 as being, this is the way God loved the world. He sent his one and only Son. So it's not just that he loved us so much, he had so much love for us that he did this. His love is actually demonstrated in him sending his Son into the world to save us. So there's an extra dimension to John 3:16. And the thing that differentiates agape love is that it is unconditional. It doesn't depend on anything the other person or people have done. It's totally unconditional. And that's why it really aptly describes the love of God. Well, how are we called to love him? We're called to love him, first of all, with all our heart. What's meant by the heart? Of the words we're going to look at, this is by far the easiest. The heart is, it's not just that organ that pumps blood around your body. Of course, it's the heart as we understand it to mean. It's the emotions, our will, our affections. So we're called to love God with all our emotions, all our will, and all our affections. The next word is a bit harder. We're called to love with all our soul. What's the soul? Well, when I thought about this, I went back to my school days. I was brought up as a Roman Catholic. And I remember when we were very young and we were in the class in school and we were being told about the soul, they said that they talk about grace and sin, and grace in the Roman Catholic religion is different than the grace that we have in the Reformed religion. When they talked about the soul, they said, whatever you do, don't think of it as a bone that has a black mark if you've got some sin, and it's wiped off if you've got a bit of grace, and that grace is on the wipes out the black mark. Don't think of it like that. Well, ever since I've said that, I can't help but think of it like that. It's a bone with black marks on. That's what we're taught at school. The Hebrew word for soul is nephesh, and it's the word that was used when Adam was created and God breathed his breath of life into Adam. That was nephesh, that was the breath of life that went into Adam. So what it really means is the whole person as a living being instilled with the breath of God, distinguishing it from just the body that doesn't have that life. So it's the whole person, the whole character, with its limitations and its capabilities. Now, I don't know, gentlemen, whether your wives ever say to you, "Why do you love me?" Or is it just me? I don't know. "Why do you love me?" And what do you say to that? Well, I'm going to get into Pat's good books now. Why do I love Pat? Well, I love her because she's that bright, bubbly personality, and she's attractive. She doesn't get angry when I make a mess of DIY jobs. She buys me Easter eggs, chocolate Easter eggs, hopefully. She looks after me when I'm ill. She puts up with me. But most of all, I love her because she's Pat. That's it's her whole essence, her whole character. So why do I love Pat? Because you're Pat. So you know what to say now, gentlemen, don't you? I'm reminded of that song by Jim Reeves, "I Love You Because," and he ends up by saying, "Didn't he? But most of all, I love you because you're you." That's why the Shema starts with those first words here, "O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." That's why it starts that way. We're called to love God not because of what he can do for us or what he does for us, although those are all reasons to love him, but we're called upon to love him because he is who he is. "I am who I am." That's why the Shema starts with those words. So it's the whole person that's involved in being called to love God. And the final word is we're called to love him with all our mind. Now that's great, isn't it? Because we're not called upon to love him with a blind faith. We're called upon to use our minds to love God. And I know a lot of what I've said today it is difficult and may go over our heads. But we're called upon to love him with our mind. We're called to use our mind and to know more and more of him through the revelation that is given to us. In the Shema, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5, you'll find that the word mind isn't used. It's translated there, depending on which version of the Bible you're using, either strength or might. And if you look at the parallel passage that I've mentioned in Mark, you'll see that in Mark it refers to loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. So in Mark it uses the wording of the Shema as well. So whilst it says mind here, it actually has a greater connotation than simply the mind. And I'm going back to look at the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, in the Shema, about where it's translated as strength, And the only time this word is translated as strength in the Bible is in reference to the wording of the Shema. In the Hebrew, the word is me'od. And me'od is a very common word in Hebrew, and it means a number of things, but its primary meaning is very. It's a word that emphasizes another word or an idea. Best translation for us is very. It's used to emphasize things. So, for example, Pat read Genesis chapter 1 earlier, and the days of creation talked about God seeing that it was good. And he says that a number of times, that it, on the various days, it sees that it was good. But when you get to the end, when you get to the end of the sixth day, what he actually says is he sees, he looks and he sees that it was me'od good. It was very good. And further on in Genesis, you read the story of Cain and Abel. And in Genesis chapter 4, verse 5, you read that Cain wasn't just angry with his brother Abel. He was me'od angry. He was very angry. Sometimes, for even more emphasis, you get a double use of the word me'od. You get in Genesis chapter 30, verse 43, we read about Jacob being me'od wealthy. He was very, very wealthy with his flocks of sheep and servants, etc. And you remember in Numbers chapter 14, when the spies are sent out to look at the promised land, and Joshua and Caleb come back, in verse 7, you hear about their report, and they say that the promised land is me'od good. Very, very good, or exceedingly good. So it's a word that emphasizes. So when it's using this word here, the word mind, it's actually an emphatic phrase in relation to what's already gone. And it tells us that we're called upon to love God totally, utterly, absolutely, with everything we've got, and in everything we do, love God. So my conclusion now, where does that leave us if that's the commandment, that we're to love God with absolutely everything, with our emotions, with all our character, absolutely, utterly and totally? Can you truthfully say that you've lived your life in total obedience to the Shema? If anybody says they can, I say you're a liar. None of us have. Isn't it a wonder that God sent, created Adam, knowing that Adam and Eve would sin against him? He knew that before he did it, and yet he still created Adam and Eve. And he, when Moses was about to die in Deuteronomy chapter 13, Moses had gone through all this, all his life, all these trials that he's gone through. He's been in Egypt, and he's led the Israelites out of Egypt. And God's given him his commandments and said, look, if you obey my commandments, you'll be blessed in this land that I'm giving to you. And yet he knows that when he goes into the promised land, God knows, when he goes into the promised land, they're going to disobey him. God knew that. And he tells Moses that in Deuteronomy chapter 31. Moses is about to die, and God says, They're going to rebel against me when they get into the promised land. And yet he still sent them into the promised land, knowing that they were going to rebel against him. Every one of you sat here today, and me, he knows that he gave birth to you knowing that you were going to rebel against him. every Sunday, and me included, it's a wonder, isn't it? The gospel is being preached by sinners. I'm a sinner, and I'm preaching the gospel to you. I apologise to Neil. The leaders are sinners. The new pastor is a sinner. We're all sinners. None of us can keep the Shema. So where does that leave us? Well, that brings us back to John 3:16, doesn't it? God so loved the world that he sent a saviour for us. He sent Jesus to die for us. So the parallel passage to John 3:16 is in Romans 5:8 that God demonstrates his love for us in this, that whilst we're still sinners, Christ died for us. That's the answer. And if you truly believe that, then you can be part of the people of God. You can have a hope. Not a hope that's like the world hopes, but a hope that is certain, that is a certainty. Because it's a hope that God provides. And anything God provides can't be taken away, because God's the greatest. So it's a certain hope. And that gives us freedom from the law. We're not bound by the law. Jesus fulfilled every aspect of the law in our place. If we fulfil the law, we do it out of love for Jesus, love for God, as a natural outpouring. But we're not bound in that sense by the law. We have a freedom. How great is the love of the Father. Amen.